And welcome back to Coast AM as we head into our open line segment. Last hour of the program, Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. And there have been a number of you who have just shown the patience of Job. And you were holding on to have a chance to speak with Tom Voigt, who was with us the previous 3 hours talking about the Zodiac Killer. He's no longer here, but I'll give you the opportunity to get it said nonetheless. And let's see. Let's begin with the wild card line. John is in Long Beach, California. John, thanks so much for hanging in.
Hi, thank you. I agree with that one caller. I think Richard Johnson did it, played the Gilligan's Island, and Don Wells and Tina Weiss helped him along with it.
Russell, you mean Russell Johnson.
Russell Johnson, I meant to say, yeah.
All right.
Anyway, I've studied this a little bit, not certainly to the extent Mr. Voigt. One thing that always puzzled me about this is serial killers usually can't stop, and this guy stopped. And I've read up on this, and even this the guy who was talking about Kaczynski, what his name is. He apparently, I've read something. It might have been from him, where this guy just decided to quit. He'd had his jollies. He went on to something else. He was a genius, and you know, focused on other things, and he would try to commit the perfect, you know, crime and perfect murders, and then went on. And that would be the rarest thing about it, because, you know, he was getting all the notoriety and then just stopped.
And that's, well, we had an email from a woman in Athens, Greece, who made that very point, John, that normally what happens is serial killers, they just keep going until they die or they're caught. And Tom said that's normally true, but there have been a few notable exceptions. And
the BTK killer in stopped for 18 years.
Yes,
picked up again, but they always seem to pick up. That's the point. The BTK killer, because he had children at home, he couldn't get away. He was able to put it off. But that's what strikes me about it, which tells me maybe why the guy got away with it, because he was obsessed with whatever he was involved in, and he took all these things, took all the steps he had to do. When he thought that he had pushed it too far, it seems to me he moved on to some other, some other pursuit that he could throw his mind totally in. And this guy that he was talking about in San Francisco might be the perfect candidate for that, because he was able to, you know, he was a computer genius. He was involved
right.
in talk music, all that stuff. And then this was just a sliver of his life, and he got away with it. You know?
It seems to add up. And if only the San Francisco police or the DA there could be motivated to just go that extra step.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
and get that comparison done. Yes.
I used to work for a newspaper in Riverside. That Sherry Bates story was well known and well documented. There are some people that think that it really was, this one wasn't tied to the Zodiac Killer. I mean, some people think that. I'm just mentioning that.
That's correct. In fact, I think the official records state that there were six victims, and Sherry Bates in River City is considered Riverside was considered a probable but not necessarily a victim. I appreciate you hanging in so long, John. Good to talk to you. Let's go to wild card line number 4 and say hi to John, this time in San Francisco. John, thanks for hanging in.
Oh, you're welcome. I used to volunteer at Artist Television Access, which was founded by Richard Gajkowski, the lead suspect.
Is that right?
So he's apparently still a celebrated figure here in San Francisco. And I was told that he's kind of protected, that he indeed did confess to the killings to the head artist there, Craig Baldwin. He's a sometimes teacher at the University of California when they can get him. He said that Craig confessed or told me that Richard confessed that he showed him the knife and the hood and the torn bloody shirt, and that he did it to develop some type of identity, that he didn't believe he had any friends. And I was told to keep quiet about it, but I wanted to kind of explore denying that and just kind of let that out.
Well, John, I'm sorry we didn't get you on earlier, but luckily you can contact Tom Voigt, reach out to him through his website, ZodiacKiller.com. He has a form there, and I'm sure if he's not aware of this bit of information already, he'd be very, very keen to know about it.
I already left him a phone message when I was calling and couldn't get in. So he already knows about it. He has my phone number. He can give me a call if he wants to know more about what Craig told me. But apparently he was a filmmaker, and all his films have been donated to the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley. So that's another source that can be looked into for little snippets of evidence or confession in his films.
John, thanks so much. I'm glad you called. Let's say hi to Mick, who's in Santa Cruz, California. I think this is our final Zodiac Killer call. Mick, thanks for holding on. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you very much. I've been waiting a while, but this is a long shot, a real long shot. In high school, 1965, 66, 67, I had a teacher who had the automobile, an English import, which was the Zodiac. And for some reason, I keep thinking that maybe the Zodiac Killer owned a Zodiac car in that period or in that time period. Anyway, we are a car culture, and maybe that's where he got his name. And in fact, it's such a rare car that it might be in a database, and one of the suspect names might be on data and the DMV. There it is. That's my thoughts.
That's a great idea. Again, I would direct you to ZodiacKiller.com and mention about, I'm sure, Tom Voigt, who's been on this case for 20 years, has thought about that. There was also a Zodiac watch.
Oh, yeah, the watch is too easy. The car is very rare, so that's where I came up with that one, yeah.
Great point. Hey, Mick, thanks for your patience. I appreciate you checking in with us. Let's say hi to a first-time caller. Ken is in San Francisco this morning. Ken, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you, my friend?
Hey, good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Thank you. I stumbled upon the Zodiac case, and I met Tom. I worked for the Department of Labor as a security instructor, and we started doing cold cases with the young students. And the Zodiac just ran on from 2004 to 2010. I've been out to all the killing sites. The one in San Francisco, Paul Stein's killing, was so intriguing to me that we go out there at night, and the killer, Zodiac, is more than one. What happened was he killed Paul Stein, walked up one block, made a right-hand turn, went three blocks down to Jackson Street, and turned into the Presidio. And that kept bothering me. And I grew up in the bad part of San Francisco. So I went up there and took some of my young friends who I grew up with, and they live other lifestyles where I know they have body counts, put it like that, okay? And I asked them, if you kill somebody, where would you run to? Because one block away is the Presidio that you can go. Why would you go three blocks down? And that kept bothering me. Three blocks down. They said, man, we're going to run and go straight into the bushes right here. What they talked about was another thing that bothered me about the Zodiac case. They said it's more than one. When he kidnapped the female and he was driving around down in Highway 123, I think it was, down there by Central California, and the woman jumped out the car and said, we're not going to throw the baby out the car. He, after she jumped out the car, he went back and drove her car a quarter of a mile and burnt the car up. Where would his car have been when he was driving her car? He would have had left his car on the side of the highway because CHP is going to come and ticket it, and they're going to have evidence that Arthur Lee Allen or whomever it was there. So it had to be someone following him in a secondary car. And I'm thinking out the box on this one right here. Another part here, let me tell you this story here. I went to another suspect house, Arthur Lee Allen, who was in Vallejo, and they were having a garage sale. A lady let me down into the basement, and I purchased two things from Arthur Lee Allen. One was a kitchen drawer, and the other was antlers. So here we are cutting these antlers down off of the garage, and I think there's going to be a note that's going to fall out, and me and this lady's going to fight about this note or something, right? And when I brought it to school to class, I had model cars up on the windowsill that the students gave me. The one car that kept falling off of the windowsill was the police car. It kept falling. These cars never, ever fell off. I started talking about the Zodiac case, and I pulled this stuff out. And a minute later, the police car just, whoop, it fell off. And I'm looking, and I'm like,
that's eerie. That is eerie, my friend. You know, I am so I'm so impressed with the depth of knowledge. You know, there are legions of these amateur sleuths out there, such as yourself. And to me, that's the greatest mystery, how this thing wasn't solved so long ago. I'm just so impressed with the knowledge of the callers tonight. Thank you for that. Heath, do we have time for... Yeah, we can squeeze Heath in from Kokomo, Indiana. Hello, Heath. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good morning. A couple of the things that I've heard in the last few hours are bothering me as a 15-year police officer and a 7-year detective in criminal investigations. I think the misconception on how DNA is used in investigations that maybe I can shed a light on.
Please, yes.
There is very strict federal laws that determine when you can use DNA and how it can be used. Just because you have a DNA sample does not mean that you can just take it and compare it to any piece of evidence. And I think that since everybody watches CSI, they believe that it's very simple. Just, oh, you have DNA, go find a killer. Well, it's not that simple. If they could have used DNA in this, I'm sure at some point in time somebody would have done so. Obviously, I don't have direct knowledge of the case, but for some detective or police agency to not be a part or want to be a part of one of the most notorious serial killer cases in the history of the United States, that really boggles my mind that they wouldn't want to jump in and say, hey, let's do it if it was possible.
I agree. I agree. That's a real head scratcher. And yet there you go. They have supposedly these two samples of DNA, one from the Zodiac killer and one from Richard Gajkowski. What would prevent them from doing a comparison? I know you're not familiar with the intricacies of this case, but give me an example, if you could, Heath, that would demonstrate what you're talking about.
Well, an example is just because you have a DNA sample from a person, you have to be able to link them with evidence to the case to be able to use them or use their DNA in a case with their permission. So you can either get a court order to get their DNA case to use it in the case, or I'm sorry, their DNA sample to use in a case, or you can get their permission, which obviously that's not going to happen in this case. Another thing that bothers me a little bit is he said that there is a source that was giving information about this person. To be able to use a source in a criminal case, the source has to be proven to be a reliable source. And if this person, I believe that he said that a detective pulled him over a couple of beers, but yeah, we didn't find him reliable. Well, there may be a reason for that. If the person's already been a proven liar in court or a liar in various cases, it doesn't matter what information he has, they still may not be able to use him legally.
So, but the rules of evidence don't the rules of evidence first look at the evidence rather than the character of the person who's bringing the evidence forward?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, absolutely. You're going to look at the evidence that they're bringing forward. But my point to that is that just because somebody says something doesn't mean you can always use that in court. If they've already proven to have perjured themselves in court, it doesn't matter what good they have to say. You may not be able to use it. But I think the part that bothered me the most was the DNA cases. That it's just not as simple as we have a DNA sample, so we want to use it. There are very strict laws that govern how that has to be used and how that can be used. There's been many cases that I'm sure they have DNA on, they just can't use it.
Well, Heath, I'm glad you called in and clarified, because I tell you, that was going to keep me up for the rest of the night and into the morning trying to figure out, well, if they've got the two samples, why can't they compare them?
Yeah, it bothers me also, and I would love to know more about like where the DNA sample was obtained at and by what method it was obtained. But obviously, that's, you know, for a different day.
All right, Heath, in Kokomo, Indiana, thanks for the call. Let's see. I think we can squeeze Steve in. No, we won't. All right, we're going to take a time out here, and when we come back, we'll get to Steve in Alaska and others. If you've got a line, hold on to it. As we head into the finish line here on Coast to Coast, our open line segment. My name is Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. Stay with us. We will return to open lines in just a few moments. I just wanted to mention another great story that webmaster Tim Banal has posted up at the coasttocoastam.com website. And this is a man who can hear Wi-Fi wherever he walks. I'm not sure if that's a talent I would want, but this is a gentleman by the name of Frank Swain, who's been going deaf since he was in his 20s, and now he's hacked his hearing aids. He somehow modified his hearing aids so that he can actually hear Wi-Fi and listen to the data that surrounds that surrounds all of us. I mean, we are swimming in this electronic smog, and this is an incredible story. We've got about 24 minutes left on open lines, and I know there are still those of you who want to talk about the Zodiac Killer. We can't shut that down, but if there's anyone who has some unique ability, like Frank Swain in his case, modified his hearing aids and he can now hear the gurgling sound of a Wi-Fi hub as he walks the streets, we'd love to hear from you. Do you have a unique talent in that regard? Back with more of Coast to Coast and Open Lines. Stay with us. And we are into the home stretch here on Coast to Coast. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Let me spell my last name. S-Y-R-E-T-T. S-Y-R-E-T-T. And the website, richardserrett.com. And I also will be back tonight with Dr. Ulf Ravenskov, a nephrologist, retired nephrologist from Sweden, who, this is pretty controversial stuff. He's arguing, and I think makes a pretty convincing case, but you'll have to be the judge when you hear him. Dr. Ravenskov argues that cholesterol is not the culprit in heart disease. So he'll talk about that. He says the cholesterol campaign is the greatest medical scandal of modern time. And then in the second hour, Richard Allen Miller, a pioneer in the annals of metaphysical and paranormal exploration, he'll discuss protocols that were developed by the Navy SEALs to create super soldiers and how these tools can be used today for your own evolution of consciousness. All right, to the phones we go, Batman. And it's Steve in Alaska who's been holding on a while. Steve, welcome to Coast. Good morning.
Yeah, Richard, you were talking earlier in the program at the beginning about the weather, talking about the cold that's pouring into the United States.
Yes, the polar vortexes. Yes.
Polar vortex. He mentioned volcanic ash possibly being part of the cause of some of this.
Apparently they affect something called the Cell-Hide winds, and that keeps the polar vortexes, you know, further south than they normally are.
Yeah, well, there's some other reasons that I've got some ideas here on what may be causing some of this. And, you know, there are HARP transmitters around the world now that can be used to change jet streams by heating the atmosphere. They also can use NEXRAD radar and these floating SBX radar systems to put blockers into the jet stream, which change the jet stream and force it up over the pole and then back into the lower 48. So what I'm talking about is weather modification or possibly even weather warfare. I think there's a lot of evidence to show that that's happening.
What is the status of the array up in Copper Valley, HARP? Is it online, offline?
Gacona. That's the Gacona HARP facility.
Yes.
It's still online. Yeah, it's still being used. There's also a large one off the coast of Baja, California. There's an island that has a large facility that's the same type of system. It uses low-frequency radio waves, extra-low frequency, and then in combination with some of these NEXRAD sites and the floating SBX radar, they can actually manipulate the jet stream, and they are. They have been doing it for years. So that's most likely the reason for the strange weather worldwide.
So you don't think it has anything to do with the polar vortexes or the volcanic ash?
No, this is something that's man-made climate change. This is something that's done being right in front of our nose, and no one's really... The awakening is happening to what's going on here. You know, you had Rob Simone had Dane Wigington on a few months ago, and he talked about geoengineering and these HARP facilities and how they're manipulating the weather. It's clear and obvious that California is being droughted out, the West Coast, and it's because they can hold the high pressure in the eastern Pacific for extended periods of time, and it changes the whole jet stream, and that's exactly what's happening. It was a great show that Rob did with Dane a few months ago, and Dane's actually, this next weekend on Friday, he's going to be doing a presentation, and he's going to have some experts out in Shasta. Actually, it's in Redding, California, at the Sequoia Middle School. and McLaughlin Auditorium at Sequoia Middle School in Reading. Friday, November 21st, 7 to 9 p.m., it's a free event, a free presentation. He's going to have Mark McCandlish. He's a former defense industry employee, 25 years. Alan Buckman, former U.S. Air Force meteorologist and a former California fish and game biologist, 38 years. Francis Mangles will be speaking, United States fish and
fish and wildlife, right. Let me ask you, Steve.
So these guys are going to speak about all this, and it's open to the public. It's in Reading, and I hope people can come. They can find out more about this on Dane's website, geoengineeringwatch.org.
Right. I know that scientists have talked about how in the future, you know, they're projecting ahead, saying in the future we may have to, go ahead with this geoengineering program, which would essentially dump, you know, tons and tons and tons of aluminum particulates, aluminum oxide, into the atmosphere, ostensibly to forestall global warming. In other words, these aluminum particulates would reflect the sun's rays back up into the atmosphere, and this would be a last ditch effort to forestall global warming. I've always suspected that, you know, when scientists say we're going to do this in the future, that means they're basically telegraphing the fact that they've already started. What do you think?
Like I said, the awakening is happening, and it's going to be catastrophic what they're doing to our planet. Biosphere collapse in the end. So I urge.
Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this?
Well, they're selling weather futures, weather derivatives on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So there may be, it looks like people may be betting on the weather and actually charging high insurance rates, and then they can control the weather so they don't have to pay out. So it's corruption at the highest level, and it's weather warfare for many, many people. I mean, for everyone, ultimately. So you can look at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange under weather derivatives or weather futures, and they're selling them for all these places, and then they can control whether they have to pay out. So they can smash storms with this HARP system. They can smash a low-pressure system or a hurricane and make it turn the other direction, just completely blow it up. So that way they can.
That's quite a racket.
It is quite a racket. So,
well, as
I appreciate
Bob Dylan,
your time tonight, and I urge people to go to geoengineeringwatch.org or check out Dane Wigington on Facebook. He's a hero of humanity, and we all need to stand together with this. This could be the end of the world if we let him go too much further with it.
Steve in Alaska, I appreciate the call. You said the awakening has begun, and to quote the great bard Bob Dylan, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Let's say hello to Ellis in South Florida. Thanks for holding on, Ellis. Welcome to Coast. Good morning.
Hey, how are you? Well, I've been here for about 9 months, left last year, and I can't wait to hear the show on the cholesterol thing because I have heart disease in my family. I'm 49, and I've been trying to take really good care of myself with hypertension. So my call, basically, I'm very disappointed. If anyone in this country is not thinking about what's going on politically and the president and the immigration issue, has got their head under the whatever. But I'm disappointed at him because he's been in there 6 years, and the American people spoke loud last week. I'm a recovering liberal. I still love my party. But
a recovering liberal.
Don't like the racial and the sexual politics. I'm a gay male, and I think what he's done with the whole of the party has backfired on him and the party, and Nancy Pelosi's caught up in her lies, and it's just not looking good. And I'm very troubled. He uses the resources of the U.S. government to bash the Republicans, and I think that's sad. And I just have to leave it at that. I think it's very sad.
And, all right, Ellis. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Let's say hello to Jay, who's in Bedford, Indiana. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Hey, doing great. Great show tonight.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, I slept a little better after I heard we had landed on P-67 there. It makes me think, you know, if there really was something coming towards the Earth, hey, we actually could maybe land on it and do something about it.
Well, yeah, but how long did it take to catch up with that comet? 10 years?
Yeah, that's the thing there. Hopefully, you know, there's the only so much of the sky we observe, they say, so.
And it took three attempts to land it. Not bad, not bad.
Well, and that's kind of my point there to maybe why it's ringing. You know, I'm talking way above my head here. I'm not a scientist or an astronomer, but maybe that thing's hollow, and when it hit it and hit it again, maybe that's created some of that resonance there.
That's interesting. You know, someone once commented that when the lunar module landed on the moon rang like a bell, which led some to suspect that maybe the moon is hollow. And maybe that's how most celestial bodies are formed, that they are, in fact, hollow spheres.
Well, there you go. There you go. And that thing you said about the guy rigging his hearing aid to hear Wi-Fi, well, you know, a lot of times I'll know when I'm getting a text message or a call. You know, maybe our brains are starting to adapt and somehow make sense of that information floating through the air.
So what happens to your brain? You can anticipate when you're going to get a text before it happens?
Well, yeah, a lot of times. I mean, it may be coincidence, but I'll usually pick my phone up or think, oh, my buddy's getting ready to call me, I bet. And sometimes it'll happen, just maybe your brain has learned to interpret that.
No, I think that's quite plausible. I think we are being rewired, and you know, in 20 years we may not recognize the human species. We're almost evolving as a result of this electronic smog and electronic gadgetry and so forth. We may constitute an entirely different species. I know sometimes I think of my first year broadcasting students that way.
Well,
I appreciate the call, Ellis in South Florida. Thank you. Likewise. Let's see. Let's say hello to it's Charles on the west of the Rocky Line, and he's calling from Wahi, Hawaii. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for being a host on Coast to Coast, the Party Line School of the Night.
But I appreciate
it. My topic is alternate energy.
Let me first, before I get to Charles, I want to make sure I've pronounced this right, because I'm a Canadian interloper, and I don't want to mispronounce your fine city. Is it Kauai? Kauai?
Kauai is the island.
Okay, Kauai is the island.
It's,
all right.
It's in the Hawaiian chain.
Sure. And that much I knew, but I wasn't sure I pronounced it correctly. Thank you for that, Charles. Okay. You want to talk about free energy?
Yes. It's one of the categories that isn't talked too much, and it's often used as the poster child for frauds and everything of violating the second law of thermodynamics. And that's where if you have a tepid pot of water, you can extract heat from one, you can make hot water and cold water simultaneously as long as the energy is the same. Then you don't get, well, anyway, trying to say that this way, you don't need to burn fuel, so you don't need to make the carbon dioxide, which, and we can power all our appliances, and our computers would have the outstanding, they wouldn't get hot, they wouldn't need cords, they wouldn't have heavy batteries, and they would run for as long as you operated them.
So how would that work again, Charles, without violating the second law of thermodynamics?
I'm saying that the second law of thermodynamics can be bypassed, because it's just a statement of belief. It doesn't have any repercussions elsewhere in science. It just is our experience since Newton found that heat would go from a fireplace down an iron rod to the outside, but not the other way. But I'm saying that with the intelligent machines that could go either way, and it'd be up to the designer to what happened.
All right. I'm not even going to pretend that I understand that, but thank you nonetheless. I appreciate the call. Nebo is in the great state of Louisiana. Nebo, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Cheers for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say something. I've been driving for about 2 hours now. Our destination is Houston. And I can say this because most people won't believe it, but I'm a time traveler. I just wanted to say something, a couple of things.
You're a time traveler? I'm all ears.
Number one, the reason why we can travel to this time frame is because it's one of the most quietest, in a way that I can put it, quietest time frames there is. As far as global warming, and the president that you have, et cetera. Those things really, when we go down to history, those things, we never even talk about it. We never even study it. Scientists right now, even in your time, are capable to manipulate the weather, are capable to protect us from comets, asteroids, meteorites. I just want to say one thing. As humans, whether it be from another country or anything, we're all human. It's going to come a time where we're all going to unite. And so just love one another. That's basically the thing that we all grow up knowing.
All right, Nebo, I appreciate the call. Our time traveler checking in from Louisiana en route to Houston. I hope you arrive safely. I've got to get this call in just because I love the name. Two Smokes is calling from Butte Falls, Oregon. Two Smokes, are you there?
I'm here.
Good morning. Can I ask?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can, sir. And how did you arrive at the name Two Smokes?
Oh, it's a long story. It's a spirit name, meaning that I carry a smoke in the spirit world and a smoke in this world. I try to keep a foot in this world, a foot in the spirit world, and be a bridge.
Wonderful. Okay. And what's on your mind tonight, this morning, Two Smokes?
Well, for about the last 3 or so years, I've been driven nuts by this humming, this resonance that comes from, seems like everywhere and nowhere at once, and like the earth. I live out in the woods, in the middle of the woods in a tent, so, and I've hiked everywhere, and I hear it everywhere I'm at. And a lot of other people hear it too, and I'm just wondering if anybody has any idea where it is, what it is and where it might be coming from.
Well, I believe there have been a number of shows on Coast about this, but there are these mysterious sounds being reported all over the world. And
Right.
Really, I know in my neck of the woods here for years, people in the city of Windsor, which is just across the river from Detroit, have been complaining about this strange, mysterious sound. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, and I know there are a number of different theories. We don't have time to get into them now, but I'm pretty sure Coast has done some programs about this. So Two Smokes, the best thing to do is become a Coast Insider, and then you can go back and check the archives, and maybe you'll get some answers. I appreciate the call. I think that's about a wrap. So listen, I want to say thanks to all of you for calling in, and for George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Gina Silvati, Tim Binal. It takes a lot of people to put this program on. And here in Toronto, Gord Harris, Scotty Guest, and Luke Cameron. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your voices, your beautiful voices. Good night.